The three horse persons sensed the change as they descended through the heavy snow clouds at the hub end of the Stowe Plain. There was a sharp scent in the air. "Can't you smell it?" said Nigel. "I remember it when I was a boy, when you could lay in bed on that first morning in winter and you could sort of taste it in the air, and..." The clouds parted below them, and there, filling the high plains country from end to end, were the herds of the ice giants. They stretched for miles in every direction, and the thunder of their stampede filled the air. The bull glaciers were in the lead, bellowing their vast creaky calls, and throwing up great sheets of earth as they ploughed relentlessly forward. Behind them pressed the great mass of cows and their calves, skimming over land already ground down to the bedrock by the leaders. They bore as much resemblance to the familiar glaciers the world thought it knew, as a lion dozing in the shade bears to 300 pounds of wickedly coordinated muscle bounding towards you with its mouth open. And when you went to the window..." Nigel's mouth, lacking any further input from his brain, ran down. Moving, jostling ice packed the plain, roaring forward under a great cloud of clammy steam. The ground shook as the leaders passed below, and it was obvious to the onlookers that whoever was going to stop this would need more than a couple of pounds of rock salt and a shovel. "Go on, then," said Canina. "Explain. I think you'd better shout." Nigel looked distractedly at the herd.
"I think I can see some figures," said Creosote helpfully. "Look, on top of the leading things."
Nigel peered through the snow. There were indeed beings moving around the backs of the glaciers. They were human or humanoid, or at least humanish. They didn't look very big. That turned out to be because the glaciers themselves were very big, and Nigel wasn't very good at perspective. As the horses flew lower over the leading glacier, a huge bull heavily crevassed and scarred by moraine, it became apparent that one reason why the ice giants were known as the ice giants was because they were, well, giants. The other was that they were made of ice. A figure the size of a large house was crouched at the crest of the bull, urging it to greater efforts by means of a spike on a long pole. It was craggy. In fact, it was more nearly faceted, and glinted green and blue in the light. There was a thin band of silver in its snowy locks, and its eyes were tiny and black and deep-set like lumps of coal. Although this was the only way in which they resembled the idols built in response to ancient and unacknowledged memories by children in snowy weather, it was extremely unlikely that this ice giant would be a small mound of grubby ice with a carrot in it by the morning. There was a splintering crash ahead as the leading glaciers smacked into a forest. Birds rattled up in panic. Snow and splinters rained down around Nigel as he galloped on the air alongside the giant. He cleared his throat.
He said. Excuse me?
Ahead of the boiling surf of earth, snow and smashed timber, a herd of caribou was running in blind panic, their rear hooves a few feet from the tumbling mess. Nigel tried again.
I say!
He shouted. The giant's head turned towards him.
What you want?
It said.
Go away, hot person.
Sorry, but is this really necessary?
The giant looked at him in frozen astonishment. It turned around slowly and regarded the rest of the herd, which seemed to stretch all the way to the hub. It looked at Nigel again.
Yes,
it said.
I think so. Otherwise, why we do it?
Only there's a lot of people out there who would prefer you not to, you see,
said Nigel desperately. A rock spire loomed briefly ahead of the glacier, rocked for a second, and then vanished. He added,
Also, children, and small furry animals.
They will suffer in the course of progress. Now is the time we've reclaimed the world,
rumbled the giant.
Whole world of ice, according to inevitability of history and triumph of thermodynamics.
Yes, but you don't have to, said Nigel.
We want to, said the giant. The gods are gone. We throw off the shackles of outmoded superstition.
Freezing the old world solid doesn't sound very progressive to me, said Nigel.
We like it.
Yes, yes, said Nigel, in the maniacally glazed tones of one who is trying to see all sides of the issue and is certain that a solution will be found if people of goodwill will only sit around a table and discuss things rationally like sensible human beings. But is this the right time? Is the world ready for the triumph of ice?
It bloody well better be,
said the giant, and swung his glacier prod at Nigel. It missed the horse, but caught him full in the chest, lifting him clean out of the saddle and flicking him onto the glacier itself. He spun, spread-eagled down its freezing flanks, was carried some way by the boil of debris, and rolled into the slush of ice and mud between the speeding walls. He staggered to his feet and peered hopelessly into the freezing fog. Another glacier bore down directly on him. So did Kanina. She leaned over as her horse swept down out of the fog, caught Nigel by his leather barbarian harness, and swung him up in front of her. As they rose again, he wheezed, "Cold-hearted bastard! I really thought I was getting somewhere for a moment there. You just can't talk to some people." The herd breasted another hill, scraping off quite a lot of it, and the Stow Plain, studded with cities, lay helpless before it. Rincewind sidled towards the nearest thing, holding coin with one hand and swinging the loaded sock in the other. "No magic, right?" he said.
"Yes," said the boy.
"Whatever happens, you mustn't use magic."
"That's it. Not here. They haven't got much power here, if you don't use magic. Once they break through, though—"
His voice trailed away. "Pretty awful," Rincewind nodded.
"Terrible," said Coyne.
Rincewind sighed. He wished he still had his hat. He'd just have to do without it. "All right," he said. "When I shout, you make a run for the light. Do you understand? No looking back or anything. No matter what happens."
"No matter what?"
said Coyne uncertainly. "No matter what." Rincewind gave a brave little smile. "Especially no matter what you hear." He was vaguely cheered to see Coyne's mouth become an O of terror. "And then," he continued, "when you get back to the other side—"
"What shall I do?"
Rincewind hesitated. "I don't know," he said. "Anything you can. As much magic as you like. Anything. Just stop them. And—"
"Yes?"
Rincewind gazed up at the thing, which was still staring into the light. "If it— you know, if anyone gets out of this, you know, and everything is all right after all, sort of thing, I'd like you to sort of tell people I sort of stayed here. Perhaps they could sort of write it down somewhere. I mean, I wouldn't want a statue or anything," he added virtuously. After a while, he added, "I think you ought to blow your nose." Coyne did so on the hem of his robe, then shook Rincewind's hand solemnly.
"If ever you—"
he began.
"That is, you're the first. It's been a great— you see, I never really—"
His voice trailed off, and then he said,
"I just wanted you to know that."
"There was something else I was trying to say," said Rincewind, letting go of the hand. He looked blank for a moment and then added, "Oh, yes, it's vital to remember who you really are. It's very important. It isn't a good idea to rely on other people or things to do it for you, you see. They always get it wrong."
"I'll try and remember," said Coyne.
"It's very important," Rincewind repeated, almost to himself. "And now I think you'd better run." Rincewind crept closer to the thing. This particular one had chicken legs, but most of the rest of it was mercifully hidden in what looked like folded wings. It was, he thought, time for a last few words. What he said now was likely to be very important. Perhaps they would be words that would be remembered and handed down, and maybe even carved deeply in slabs of granite. Words without too many curly letters in, therefore. "I really wish I wasn't here," he muttered. He hefted the sock, whirled it once or twice, and smashed the thing on what he hoped was its kneecap. It gave a shrill buzz, spun wildly with its wings creaking open, lunged vaguely at Rincewind with its vulture head, and got another sock full of sand on the upswing. Rincewind looked around desperately as the thing staggered back and saw Coyne still standing where he had left him. To his horror, he saw the boy begin to walk towards him, hand raised instinctively to fire the magic which here would doom them both. "Run away, you idiot!" he screamed as the thing began to gather itself for a counter-attack. From out of nowhere he found the words, "You know what happens to boys who are bad!" Coyne went pale, turned, and ran towards the light. He moved as though through treacle, fighting against the entropy slope. The distorted image of the world turned inside out, hovered a few feet away, then inches, wavering uncertainly. A tentacle curled around his leg, tumbling him forward. He flung his hands out as he fell, and one of them touched snow. It was immediately grabbed by something else that felt like a warm, soft leather glove, but under the gentle touch was a grip as tough as tempered steel, and it tugged him forward, also dragging whatever it was that had caught him. Light and grainy dark flickered around him, and suddenly he was sliding over cobbles slicked with ice. The librarian let go his hold and stood over Coyne with a length of heavy wooden beam in his hand. For a moment the ape reared against the darkness, the shoulder, elbow, and wrist of his right arm unfolding in a poem of applied leverage, and in a movement as unstoppable as the dawn of intelligence, brought it down very heavily. There was a squashy noise, and an offended screech, and the burning pressure on Coyne's leg vanished. The dark column wavered. There were squeals and thumps coming from it, distorted by distance. Coyne struggled to his feet and started to run back into the dark, but this time the librarian's arm blocked his path.
"We can't just leave him in there!"
The ape shrugged. There was another crackle from the dark, and then a moment of almost complete silence. But only almost complete. Both of them thought they heard, a long way off but very distinct, the sound of running feet fading into the distance. They found an echo in the outside world. The ape glanced around and then pushed Coyne hurriedly to one side as something squat and battered and with hundreds of little legs barreled across the stricken courtyard and, without so much as pausing in its stride, leapt into the disappearing darkness, which flickered for one last time and vanished. There was a sudden flurry of snow across the air where it had been. Coyne wrenched free of the librarian's grip and ran into the circle, which was already turning white. His feet scuffed up a sprinkle of fine sand.
"He didn't come out," he said.
"Ook," said the librarian, in a philosophic manner.
"I thought he'd come out, you know, just at the last minute."
"Ook."
Coyne looked closely at the cobbles, as if by mere concentration he could change what he saw.
"Is he dead?"
"Ook,"
observed the librarian, contriving to imply that Rincewind was in a region where even things like time and space were a bit iffy, and it was probably not very useful to speculate as to his exact state at this point in time, if indeed he was at any point in time at all, and that, all in all, he might even turn up tomorrow, or for that matter yesterday, and finally, that if there was any chance at all of surviving, then Rincewind almost certainly would.
"Oh," said Coyne.
He watched the librarian shuffle around and head back for the Tower of Art, and a desperate loneliness overcame him.
"I say,"
he yelled.
"Ook?"
"What should I do now?"
"Ook?"
Coyne waved vaguely at the desolation.
"You know, perhaps I could do something about all this," he said in a voice tilting on the edge of terror. "Do you think that would be a good idea? I mean, I could help people. I'm sure you'd like to be human again, wouldn't you?"
The librarian's everlasting smile hoisted itself a little further up his face, just enough to reveal his teeth.
"Okay, perhaps not," said Coyne hurriedly, "but there's other things I could do, isn't there?"
The librarian gazed at him for some time, then dropped his eye to the boy's hand. Coyne gave a guilty start and opened his fingers. The ape caught the little silver ball neatly before it hit the ground and held it up to one eye. He sniffed it, shook it gently, and listened to it for a while. Then he wound up his arm and flung it away as hard as possible.
"What?"
Coyne began, and landed full length in the snow when the librarian pushed him over and dived on top of him. The ball curled over the top of its arc and tumbled down, its perfect path interrupted suddenly by the ground. There was a sound like a harp string breaking, a brief babble of incomprehensible voices, a rush of hot wind, and the gods of the disc were free. They were very angry.
"There is nothing we can do here, is there?"
said Creosote. "No," said Canina.
"The ice is going to win, isn't it?"
said Creosote.
"Yes,"
said Canina.
"No,"
said Nigel. He was trembling with rage, or possibly with cold, and was nearly as pale as the glaciers that rumbled past below them. Canina sighed.
"Well, just how do you think?" she began.
"Take me down somewhere a few minutes ahead of them," said Nigel.
"I really don't see how that would help."
"I wasn't asking your opinion," said Nigel quietly. "Just do it. Put me down a little way ahead of them, so I've got a while to get sorted out."
"Get what sorted out?" Nigel didn't answer.
"I said," said Canina, "get what?"
"Shut up!"
"I don't see what..."
"Look," said Nigel, with the patience that lies just short of axe murdering, "the ice is going to cover the whole world, right? Everyone's going to die, okay? Except us for a little while, I suppose, until these horses want their oats, or the lavatory, or whatever, which isn't much use to us, except maybe Creosote will just about have time to write a sonnet or something about how cold it is all of a sudden, and the whole of human history is about to be scraped up, and in these circumstances I would like very much to make it completely clear that I am not about to be argued with. Is that absolutely understood?" He paused for breath, trembling like a harp string. Canina hesitated. Her mouth opened and shut a few times, as though she was considering arguing, and then she thought better of it. They found a small clearing in a pine forest a mile or two ahead of the herd, although the sound of it was clearly audible, and there was a line of steam above the trees, and the ground was dancing like a drum top. Nigel strolled to the middle of the clearing and made a few practice swings with his sword. The others watched him thoughtfully.
"If you don't mind," whispered Creosote to Kanina, "I'll be off. It's at times like this that sobriety loses its attractions, and I'm sure the end of the world will look a lot better through the bottom of a glass, if it's all the same to you. Do you believe in paradise, oh peach-cheeked blossom?"
"Not as such, no."
"Oh," said Creosote. "Well, in that case, we probably won't be seeing each other again," he sighed. "What a waste. All this just because of a gears. Of course, if by some unthinkable chance..."
"Goodbye," said Kanina. Creosote nodded miserably, wheeled his horse, and disappeared over the treetops. Snow was shaking down from the branches around the clearing. The thunder of the approaching glaciers filled the air. Nigel started when she tapped him on the shoulder and dropped his sword. "What are you doing here?" he snapped, fumbling desperately in the snow.
"Look, I'm not prying or anything," said Kanina meekly, "but what exactly do you have in mind?"
She could see a rolling heap of bulldozed snow and soil bearing down on them through the forest, the mind-numbing sound of the leading glaciers now overlaid with the rhythmic snapping of tree trunks. And advancing implacably above the tree line, so high that the eye mistook them at first for sky, the blue-green prows.
"Nothing," said Nigel. "Nothing at all. We're just going to resist them, but that's all there is to it. That's what we're here for."
"But it won't make any difference," she said.
"It will to me. If we're going to die anyway, I'd rather die like this, heroically."
"Is it heroic to die like this?" said Kanina.
"I think it is," he said. "And when it comes to dying, there's only one opinion that matters."
"Oh."
A couple of deer blundered into the clearing, ignored the humans in their blind panic, and rocketed away.
"You don't have to stay," said Nigel. "I've got this gears, you see."
Kanina looked at the back of her hands.
"I think I should," she said, and added, "You know, I thought maybe, you know, if we could just get to know one another better."
"Mr. and Mrs. Harebutt is what you had in mind?"
he said bluntly. Her eyes widened.
"Well,"
she began.
"Which one did you intend to be?"
he said. The leading glacier smashed into the clearing just behind its bow wave, its top lost in a cloud of its own creation. At exactly the same time, the trees opposite it bent low as a hot wind blew from the rim. It was loaded with voices, petulant, bickering voices, and tore into the clouds like a hot iron into water. Kanina and Nigel threw themselves down into the snow, which turned to warm slush under them. Something like a thunderstorm crashed overhead, filled with shouting and what they at first thought were screams, although, thinking about them later, they seemed more like very angry arguments. It went on for a long time, and then began to fade in the direction of the hub. Warm water flooded down the front of Nigel's vest. He lifted himself cautiously, and then nudged Kanina. Together they scrambled through the slush and mud to the top of the slope, climbed through a logjam of smashed timber and boulders, and stared at the scene. The glaciers were retreating, under a cloud stuffed with lightning. Behind them, the landscape was a network of lakes and pools.
"Did we do that?"
said Kanina.
"It would be nice to think so, wouldn't it?"
said Nigel.
"Yes, but did we?"
she began.
"Probably not. Who knows? Let's just find a horse," he said. "The Apogee," said War. "Or something, I'm pretty sure."
They had staggered out of the inn and were sitting on a bench in the afternoon sunshine. Even War had been persuaded to take off some of his armour.
"Dunno," said Famine. "Don't think so."
Pestilence shut his crusted eyes and leaned back against the warm stones.
"I think," he said, "it was something about the end of the world."
War sat and thoughtfully scratched his chin. He hiccuped.
"What, the whole world?"
he said.
"I reckon."
War gave this some further consideration.
"I reckon we're well out of it, then,"
he said. People were returning to Ankh-Morpork, which was no longer a city of empty marble, but was once again its old self, sprawling as randomly and colourfully as a pool of vomit outside the all-night takeaway of history. And the university had been rebuilt, or had rebuilt itself, or in some strange way had never been unbuilt. Every strand of ivy, every rotting casement, was back in place. The sorcerer had offered to replace everything as good as new, all wood sparkling, all stone unstained, But the librarian had been very firm on the subject. He wanted everything replaced as good as old. The wizards came creeping back with the dawn, in ones or twos, scuttling for their old rooms, trying to avoid one another's gaze, trying to remember a recent past that was already becoming unreal and dreamlike. Kanina and Nigel arrived around breakfast time, and out of kindness found a livery stable for War's horse, which wisely decided not to fly again, was never claimed, and lived out the rest of its days as the carriage horse of an elderly lady. What War did about this is unrecorded. It is pretty certain that he got another one. It was Kanina who insisted that they look for Rincewind at the university, and who therefore first saw the books. They were flying out of the Tower of Art, spiralling around the university buildings, and swooping through the door of the reincarnated library. One or two of the more impudent grimoires were chasing sparrows, or hovering hawk-like over the quad. The librarian was leaning against the doorway, watching his charges with a benevolent eye. He waggled his eyebrows at Kanina, the nearest he ever got to a conventional greeting. "Is Rincewind here?" she said.
"Ook."
"Sorry?" The ape didn't answer, but took them both by the hand, and walking between them like a sack between two poles, led them across the cobbles to the tower. There were a few candles alight inside, and they saw Coin seated on a stool. The librarian bowed them into his presence like an ancient retainer in the oldest family of all, and withdrew. Coin nodded at them.
"He knows when people don't understand him," he said. "Remarkable, isn't he?"
"Who are you?" said Kanina.
"Coin," said Coin.
"Are you a student here?"
"I'm learning quite a lot, I think."
Nigel was wandering around the walls, giving them the occasional prod. There had to be some good reason why they didn't fall down, but if there was, it didn't lie in the realms of civil engineering.
"Are you looking for Rincewind?" said Coin.
Kanina frowned.
"How did you guess that?"
"He told me some people would come looking for him."
Kanina relaxed. "Sorry," she said. "We've had a bit of a trying time. I thought perhaps it was magic or something. He's all right, isn't he? I mean, what's been happening? Did he fight the sorcerer?"
"Oh, yes, and he won. It was very interesting. I saw it all. But then he had to go," said Coin, as though reciting.
"What, just like that?" said Nigel.
"Yes."
"I don't believe it," said Kanina. She was beginning to crouch, her knuckles whitening.
"It is true," said Coin. "Everything I say is true. It has to be."
"I want to—" Kanina began, and Coin stood up, extended a hand, and said, "Stop."
She froze. Nigel stiffened in mid-frown.
"You will leave," said Coin, in a pleasant, level voice, "and you will ask no more questions. You will be totally satisfied. You will have all your answers. You will live happily ever after. You will forget hearing these words. You will go now."
They turned slowly and woodenly, like puppets, and trooped to the door. The librarian opened it for them, ushered them through, and shut it behind them. Then he stared at Coin, who sagged back onto the stool.
All right," said the boy, "but it was only a little magic. I had to. You said yourself people had to forget."
"Ooh!
I can't help it. It's too easy to change things." He clutched his head. "I've only got to think of something. I can't stay. Everything I touch goes wrong. It's like trying to sleep on a heap of eggs. This world is too thin. Please tell me what to do."
The librarian spun around on his bottom a few times, a sure sign of deep thought. Exactly what he said is not recorded, but Coin smiled, nodded, shook the librarian's hand, and opened his own hands and drew them up and around him and stepped into another world. It had a lake in, and some distant mountains, and a few pheasants watching him suspiciously from under the trees. It was the magic all sorcerers learned eventually. Sorcerers never become part of the world, they merely wear it for a while. He looked back halfway across the turf and waved at the librarian. The ape gave him an encouraging nod. And then the bubble shrank inside itself, and the last sorcerer vanished from this world and into a world of his own. Although it has nothing much to do with the story, it is an interesting fact that about 500 miles away, a small flock, or rather in this case a herd, of birds, were picking their way cautiously through the trees. They had heads like flamingos, bodies like a turkey, and legs like a sumo wrestler. They walked in a jerky, bobbing fashion, as though their heads were attached to their feet by elastic bands. They belonged to a species unique even among disc fauna, in that their prime means of defence was to cause a predator to laugh so much that they could run away before it recovered. Rincewind would have been vaguely satisfied to know that they were gears. Custom was slow in the mended drum. The troll, chained to the doorpost, sat in the shade and reflectively picked someone out of his teeth. Creosote was singing softly to himself. He had discovered beer, and wasn't having to pay for it, because the coinage of compliments, rarely employed by the swains of Ankh, was having an astonishing effect on the landlord's daughter. She was a large, good-natured girl, with a figure that was the colour and, not to put too fine a point on it, the same shape as unbaked bread. She was intrigued. No one had ever referred to her breasts as jewelled melons before.
"Absolutely," said the Seraph, sliding peacefully off his bench. "No doubt about it."
"Either the big yellow sort, or the small green ones with huge warty veins," he told himself, virtuously.
"And what was it about my hair?"
she said encouragingly, hauling him back and refilling his glass.
"Oh," the Seraph's brow wrinkled, "like a goat of flocks that grazes on the slopes of Mount, what's the name, and no mistake. And as for your ears," he added quickly, "no pink-hued shells that grace the sea-kissed sands of—" "Exactly how like a flock of goats," she said.
The Seraph hesitated. He'd always considered it one of his best lines. Now it was meeting Ankh Morpork's famous literal-mindedness head-on for the first time. Strangely enough, he felt rather impressed.
"I mean in size, shape, or smell," she went on. "I think," said the Seraph, "that perhaps the phrase I had in mind was exactly not like a flog of gits."
"Huh?" The girl pulled the flagon toward her.
"And I think perhaps I would like another drink," he said, indistinctly. And then...
He looked sideways at the girl and took the plunge.
"Are you much of a raconteur?"
"What?" He licked his suddenly dry lips.
"I mean, do you know many stories?"
he croaked.
"Oh, yes, lots."
"Lots?" whispered Creosote. Most of his concubines only knew the same old one or two.
"Hundreds? Why, do you want to hear one?"
"What, now?"
"If you like, it's not very busy in here."
"Perhaps I did die," Creosote thought. "Perhaps this is paradise." He took her hand.
"You know," he said, "it's ages since I've had a good narrative, but I wouldn't want you to do anything you don't want to do."
She patted his arm. "What a nice old gentleman," she thought, "compared to some we get in here."
"There's one my granny used to tell me. I know it backwards," she said.
Creosote sipped his beer and watched the wall in a warm glow. "Hundreds," he thought, "and she knows some of them. Backwards." She cleared her throat and said in a sing-song voice that made Creosote's pulse fuse.
"There was a man, and he had 8 sons."
The patrician sat by his window, writing. His mind was full of fluff as far as the last week or two was concerned, and he didn't like that much. A servant had lit a lamp to dispel the twilight, and a few early evening moths were orbiting it. The patrician watched them carefully. For some reason he felt very uneasy in the presence of glass, but that, as he stared fixedly at the insects, wasn't what bothered him most. What bothered him was that he was fighting a terrible urge to catch them with his tongue. And Waffles lay on his back at his master's feet, and barked in his dreams. Lights were going on all over the city, but the last few strands of sunset illuminated the gargoyles as they helped one another up the long climb to the roof. The librarian watched them from the open door while giving himself a philosophic scratch. Then he turned and shut out the night. It was warm in the library. It was always warm in the library, because the scatter of magic that produced the glow also gently cooked the air. The librarian looked at his charges approvingly, made his last rounds of the slumbering shelves, and then dragged his blanket underneath his desk, ate a good-night banana, and fell asleep. Silence gradually reclaimed the library. Silence drifted around the remains of a hat, heavily battered and frayed and charred around the edges, that had been placed with some ceremony in a niche in the wall. No matter how far a wizard goes, He will always come back for his hat. Silence filled the university in the same way that air fills a hole. Night spread across the disk like plum jam, or possibly blackberry preserve. But there would be a morning. There would always be another morning. That is The End of Sorcery by Terry Pratchett, and it was read by Nigel Planer.